Hello and welcome to the Money Nerds Podcast, where owning a calculator, budgeting your money, and having a net worth is actually cool. I'm your host, Whitney Hansen, and each week I'll be chatting with inspiring people to learn their secrets to financial success. Now let's dive into the show. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. So I have been collecting a lot of your questions and there are some seriously good ones in here, but it's always fun to have a different perspective and a different, I guess, viewpoint from all of the questions that you ask. So I have brought on my friend Paula Pant and also former guest of the show. Paula, thank you so much for hanging out.
Thank you for inviting me on. I'm excited to be here.
Same. So this is going to be good. The questions that are coming through are really awesome and a little bit diverse. So are you ready to just dive in and start answering these?
Oh, I was born ready. Let's do it.
I know you were too. Side note, how's your podcast going?
Oh, the podcast is fantastic. So I'm the host of the Afford Anything podcast and loving it. We also answer questions every other episode. So we've got a lot of good questions in and a huge number of really awesome guests too.
Amazing. Yeah, your podcast is one of my favorites. So it's always fun listening in.
All right. Thank you.
Well, let's do this. Okay. The first question comes from Michelle. Michelle says, my husband and I have been relaxed on paying his student loan. He's on the income repayment plan. I never wanted to look at it, but I know it's a lot and I didn't know how much. So this year I told him I wanted to tackle this loan. It's the only debt we have. We just looked at it. I'm not shocked, just overwhelmed. It's broken into 7 different loans, all ranging from 5.5% to 6.55% interest rates. On the income repayment plan, I also just found out none of the payment is going towards principal, all to interest. I have no idea how to tackle this or if the interest rates are even any good. Any suggestions on where to start? Paula, what do you think about this?
Well, so first of all, so the income-driven repayment plan is designed to make your payments more manageable, right? The purpose of the income-driven repayment plan is that it lowers your monthly payment so that that doesn't take up too big a bite out of your income. Mm-hmm. And that's the benefit of it. But the drawback is that you don't make as much progress. Like, in order to make progress on a loan, it does need to take a bigger bite of your income, or you need a higher income, or both. Mm-hmm. So what I would recommend for Michelle is, she mentioned it's broken up into 7 different loans.
Yeah.
There are a couple of different theories around how to pay off loans. And one of the theories, which Whitney, I know that you're familiar with, is called the debt snowball. And under this theory, you take the loan with the smallest total balance and you pay that off first, regardless of interest rate. And Michelle, in your case, the interest rate there's only a 1% difference between the lowest and the highest anyway. So most of your loans have a pretty similar interest rate to one another. But you take the loan with the smallest balance, throw every extra penny that you can towards it, pay that off, and then you get the psychological thrill of victory that comes with knocking that number 7 down to a number 6. And the idea is that that small win, that psychological thrill of victory, is what keeps you motivated to knock out the next one and then the next one.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing too about the debt snowball. I think that would be a really good way to tackle the loans together as a couple and see that progress. The thing that immediately hit me, and I'm not sure if this is the case, Michelle, but one of the things that stood out to me was that it could feel like there is no money going towards principal. And that might be the case if it was an unsubsidized loan, basically meaning the government isn't helping you cover some of the costs of that interest while you're still in school. And if that was deferred at any point too, that would also extend that. So that could be the case. But yeah, unfortunately, you have to pay off all that interest first, which sucks. It hurts, but that's kind of the way that works. I don't know if I'd recommend refinancing. Paula, did you have any thoughts on refinancing or doing some type of consolidation loan?
No. I think that, the interest rates on those loans are pretty good. Mm-hmm. They're not bad. And if you think about it, like between 5.5% to 6.5%, think about a mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. When people take out a home mortgage, most people don't think I'm in 6 figures of debt, right? Even though that is what happens when you take out a mortgage. Most people don't think that way. Like, most people don't get overwhelmed by the idea of being 6 figures in debt on a loan that's going to last for the next 30 years, even though that's exactly what's happening. And there are a lot of mortgages that are 5.5% to 6.5% historically. you know, recently mortgage rates have been a little bit lower because we've gone through the Great Recession in the last decade. Mm-hmm. But historically, 5.5% to 6.5%, which is what you're paying on the student loans, is actually about what you might pay on a mortgage. So if it helps, Michelle, think of this as essentially kind of like having a house payment. Mm-hmm. And if that helps it feel not as overwhelming, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you think of it like that, then it's just a payment at a pretty historically reasonable interest rate that you knock out one piece at a time.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And the interest rates to me didn't stand out as being overly high. I think that's pretty normal for federal loans. So I think you're on track, Michelle. It sucks. I'm sorry that it's a lot. It can feel overwhelming, but I think the advice that Paula shared of just taking it one little debt at a time will truly help you as a couple and help you wrap your head around that massive amount of debt. It makes it a little bit more manageable.
Yeah, I think Michelle, the advantage that you have is that because it's broken out into 7 different loans, that does set things up such that you can knock them out one at a time. So the difference between having 7 small loans versus one giant loan is if you have that one giant loan, it can feel like you're never making progress. Mm-hmm. But because this is broken up as 7 different loans, then you make the minimum payment that you need to on the rest of them, and then you just pick one and you're like, that's the one. Mm-hmm. I'm getting rid of that one. And that it sets you up to feel as though you're making more progress. And that is, I think, the biggest motivation. Because what I hear in your question, what you said was, I feel frustrated, I feel overwhelmed. And so the first thing that we need to address is how can you feel less overwhelmed? And focusing on just one out of those 7 is a good way to do that.
Yeah. Oh, good advice. Shall we move on to the next question?
Let's do it.
Okay. This one comes from Katie with a Y. Katie says, hi, my husband and I have been listening to the podcast and following in the group. So that's the Manage Your Money Like a Boss group, guys. So make sure you join in. It's a ton of fun. New Year's Day, we had a money date and made our big goals for the year. What are some rewards you do when you complete a goal? I think it would help us stay focused for the whole year. Killer question. Paula, how do you stay motivated when you accomplish goals? What do you do?
Wow. Okay. So interestingly, there's a theory about rewards. This comes from Gretchen Rubin. She was a guest on my podcast. And apparently the research around this shows that if you set up a reward that is unrelated to or extrinsic to the goal, then that actually can be counterproductive. So, for example, let's say that you go running every morning and your reward at the end of the run is a blueberry muffin. That reward can actually be counterproductive because then your brain doesn't learn to enjoy running inherently. It sees running as a means to an end, a way to get that blueberry muffin. And so if you are going to set up a reward, make the reward something that is intrinsically related to the goal itself. So in the running example, the reward could be as simple as an appreciation for that feeling of the runner's high that you get when you run. Mm. Or if you wanted to go a little bit outside of that and make it, something like it could be a really solid pair of running shoes or a really awesome running outfit, right? But the reward should either be inherent to the goal or it should further the goal. It shouldn't be something unrelated.
Crazy. I've never heard that. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And that was from Gretchen Rubin?
Yeah, that's research that Gretchen Rubin cited.
Wow, I love that. So what do you personally do? What's a financial goal that you recently accomplished, Paula, that you celebrated?
Jeez.
I know.
What is a financial
goal? I can't think of
what
any for me
What is a financial
either.
Goal that I've recently accomplished? I guess I had a revenue goal for last year.
Oh, good.
In terms of my business. And I reached that revenue goal. Honestly, I mean, the biggest way that I celebrated it was I wrote myself a post-it with the goal that I reached last year. I put it on my monitor so that I could see it every single day, so I could see the fact that I had made that victory.
That's cool.
And then underneath that, I wrote a new revenue goal for this year. So in that one, I don't know if that's a good example or not, but in that one post-it that I look at every single day, I can see the victory that I achieved last year, mm-hmm. and I see that next to the goal for this year.
That's cool. I like that. I do. And as I asked you that question too, I was thinking about my own goals. I'm like, what the hell did I accomplish this year? Like, I don't even know.
Right?
I'm like, crap, I'm not sure. So sorry for putting you on the spot there. Here's a weird thing you can try, Katie. This is a little different, but I think it could be really fun because it helps you celebrate all of your goals at one time. And so basically, I like to take mini weekend trips. I won't suggest that unless it's inherent to the goal. I think that's really good advice now that I know that. I'm switching up my strategy. But one thing that you and your partner can try is you can write down the goal that you accomplished on a little piece of paper, and then each of you write down the feelings that you feel when you accomplish that goal. What's cool about it? How good does that feel? You know, how hard did you work for that? Write that on a little piece of paper, put it in a box, and then save that box until next year. And then next year, pull out that box, grab a glass of wine, and together go through those goals to see all the cool stuff you accomplished together. I think to me, that's a really fun way to keep celebrating and then reflect on those feelings that you felt. So it's not just a one and done kind of thing, move the bar up and keep moving forward. You can actually pause and reflect on all the cool stuff that you did. So that's one suggestion that you might do and see if it works for you.
Nice.
All right. We've got another.
What kind of weekend trips do you like to take?
Oh, God. Hiking ones. Hiking ones. Typically, I mean, you know me. I'm kind of crazy with this stuff. I like to do longer road trips over a weekend trip, which sounds completely crazy. But for me, it's fun. I grab a cup of coffee. I have my sunflower seeds. I get a cruise for 5 or 6 hours and listen to podcasts and audiobooks and then go on a really awesome hike and then typically come back and go back to work. But I love it. It's good for me. What about for you?
I like getting outdoors. So oftentimes I'll go on a hike or even just go to the park and just take a long walk while listening to podcasts or audiobooks.
That's fun. Any audiobook suggestions? I'm actually looking for a new one right now.
Well, I just finished Becoming by Michelle Obama, and which, you know, is regardless of anyone's political stance, it's a really interesting story. It's a really interesting just biography of a person. The next one that I'm about to start is called Fortune's Children, and it's the story of the Vanderbilt family and how they gained and then lost their fortune. So it's the story of how this one of America's richest families squandered their whole fortune over the course of just a couple of generations.
Oh my gosh, that'll be good. I'm excited to see what you think.
Yeah, that was also a recommendation from one of my former podcast guests. I asked him what he was reading, and he said he was reading that book, and so I got it on audiobook.
Very cool. We'll have to start a little book club here, guys. Be fun. All right. Shall we do another question?
Let's do it.
This is also from Katie, but Katie with an IE. Katie asks, if you can't access VTSAX, so that's the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund, through your employer 401k, which is through Vanguard, what would be the best next index fund to put your retirement investment into?
Call on me.
Oh, Paula, what do you think?
So I have exactly the same problem. I'm self-employed, so I have a solo Roth 401k through Vanguard, and I am not allowed. Vanguard's own internal policies is that I am not allowed to buy VTSAX through my retirement account that I have with them. And so here's the thing. So VTSAX is the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund, but there are two different variations of this fund. There's investor shares and Admiral shares. Now, the Admiral shares, which is VTSAX, has a significantly lower expense ratio. And unfortunately, I'm not allowed to buy that one, and neither are you, Katie. But the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund investor shares, which is VTSMX, it's exactly the same fund. The only difference is that you pay more. You pay a higher fee. You pay a higher expense ratio, which sucks. But that's the only way that I'm allowed to buy the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund. So, Katie, it sounds like you and I are in the same boat. And so so what I did was I bought VTSMX. Unfortunately, I just looked this up as we've been talking. VTSMX, according to the Vanguard website, is now closed to new investors.
No!
So here, I know, right? So here is the workaround. It's also, okay, so The same fund, there are index funds and there are ETFs. An ETF is an exchange-traded fund. Now, in terms of functionality, an index fund and an ETF, for our purposes, more or less are the same thing. Mm-hmm. Technically, an index fund is traded like a mutual fund, which means that when you buy or sell it, that trade happens at the close of the trading day, mm-hmm. whereas an ETF is traded in real time, like in a matter of seconds. So that is, if you want to get technical, the difference between an ETF versus an index fund. But for our purposes as long-term investors who aren't making split-second trades, mm-hmm. we don't really care. So you can get into this fund as an ETF, which the ticker symbol for that is VTI. Mm-hmm. That's the workaround.
Spot on. I was going to suggest the exact same thing. So the VTI, the exchange traded fund, a lot of times, I don't know if this is the case. My assumption is that 401ks sometimes won't allow you that bigger purchase because like the VTSAX, the minimum investment, I believe, is like $10,000. So I could see maybe that's why. I'm not quite sure.
Well, I have a six-figure amount in the higher cost Vanguard Total Stock Market Investor shares.
What the heck then?
It's really frustrating. Vanguard. I have like, yeah, it's super, super frustrating. I have, you know, more than 10 times the minimum and they still they're, yeah.
Darn.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a bummer. So the ETF, Katie, it sounds like that's the way to go. I think that expense ratio is pretty low too, about 0.04%, which is the same as the VTSAX last time I checked. So I think you're in good luck there. And I think that would be a good option.
Absolutely.
Okay. That was a good question. So next one is from Sarah. Sarah said, what is the most dramatic or radical change you've made that resulted in the greatest positive impact on your finances? Just curious. Good question, Sarah. I like it. Paula, what's pretty radical about your life that you've done?
So the most radical thing that I did was house hacking. So I bought a three-unit property. Like, rather than, you know, most people, when they buy their first home, they buy a home and then they move into it. And then that's the end of the story, right? What I did was I bought a three-unit building, which is called a triplex, moved into one of the units with roommates, and then rented out the other two units. And so between the renting out the other two units plus the rent that I was getting from my roommates in the unit that we shared together, between all of those people, I had zero out-of-pocket housing costs. So I got to live for free, not paying anything for my own housing. And because of that, I was able to radically save. And it's funny because when people talk to me about that purchase, a lot of people are like, whoa, you bought a rental property. How did you get the money for that? But really, if you think about it, what I did was way cheaper than what everybody else does. Everybody else buys a house and then they have to make their own mortgage payments out of pocket. Whereas what I did was I set it up so that I never had to make a mortgage payment out of pocket. So that was what I did. It was radical, unusual. I lived with roommates until I was 31. That's the way I got ahead.
I'd say that's pretty radical. I think that's actually really a smart idea. And I like you emphasized too that it seems like it would be more expensive and it actually was the cheaper option or the best option for you. I think that's a really good point is when we make these big decisions, don't think so short term. Think about the longer term impact. And for you, free rent? Heck yeah. Who wouldn't do that? I think that's amazing.
Exactly. Yeah, it always surprises me because in interviews, people often are like, well, how did you get the money to buy that rental property? And I'm like, why aren't you interviewing every other person on the street saying, how did you get the money to buy your first house?
Right.
Because that's going to be a lot more expensive if you're paying your own mortgage out of pocket. Right.
Exactly the case. It's always so interesting. I'm trying to think the most radical or dramatic thing that I have done. I feel like I do a lot of weird things, but the ones that made the biggest impact on my finances were two things. First, going at my own pace and not comparing my financial situation to others. That allowed me to stay in my own lane and make the best decisions for my own life. So that sounds like a really simple thing, but it's actually pretty radical because most of us don't do that. Mm. And then the second piece for me is I don't drive cars that are newer. I don't finance cars. I pay cash and I drive it until it's pretty old. So my new to me car was still an old car that I purchased a year ago. It's a 2004 Nissan Murano, which was an upgrade from my 2001 Toyota Celica. So for me, that's pretty radical, but it saves me so much money by not having car payments. So I don't know. Those are two things that I personally do.
Nice. I do the same thing. I love used cars.
They're so good, right? You save so much money.
Exactly. Buying a new car is just like throwing $100 bills out the window to depreciation.
It's so true. It is so true. One of the funniest things, too, one of my coaching clients mentioned that her car was a 2008 or 2010. And I was like, oh, dang, girl, you got a newer car. And then I had to stop. I'm like, oh, wait, that's not that new. So it starts to actually train you. So then when you get a nicer or a slightly newer-ish car, you appreciate some of the features a lot more. So it's kind of interesting. I'm just a big fan of driving old cars. I think it makes such a big difference.
Exactly. I agree.
Do you have any issues? So you drive older cars as well. A lot of people think they're not quite as reliable. Have you came across any problems with your vehicles over the years?
No, not at all. I mean, so I drive typically Toyotas or Hondas or Nissans. And so I think those are very reliable, well-built cars. You know, they're stable. They tend to hold their value really well. They tend to be good cars. So, and the other thing is, if you think about it, even if you, let's say that you buy a car for $5,000 and you have to put $1,000 or $2,000 into repairing it, that's still going to be a lot cheaper than buying a $20,000 new brand new vehicle.
Oh yeah. 100%. It seems like so much, and the car dealers are really good at this too. They know to sell you on the minimum payment, your monthly payment, instead of showing you this is the overall cost of the vehicle and the financing piece and the yearly impact. If you take that car payment and times it by 12, I think that opens your eyes so much too of how much money we just throw away in cars, which you're never going to get back. It doesn't return you any money at all. So yeah, exactly. I don't know. That's my radical thing, but great questions, guys. Paula, thank you so much for hanging out. For everybody that wants to learn more from you, where do they go?
If you take out your favorite podcast player and search for Afford Anything, that's the name of my podcast. It's the Afford Anything podcast. So come look me up on the Afford Anything podcast and hit subscribe so that you can listen to me answer more questions and interview great guests. You can also find me on online at affordanything.com.
Love it. Paula, thank you so much for hanging out. Guys, if you want your questions to be answered by me and another guest, then make sure you send them my way. You can either send me an email, whitney@whitneyhanson.com, or in the private Facebook group, Manager Money Like a Boss. But I will be collecting those and doing these from time to time. So yeah, thank you so much again, Paula. I appreciate you hanging out.
Absolutely. Thank you.